Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the 2006 publication of super bestseller Three Cups of Tea made Greg Mortensen the world's most famous school builder. The story of the one-time mountaineer lost in the mountains of Pakistan, promising to build a school and educate girls, has touched millions of hearts. Now Mortensen is building schools in Afghanistan, too. And he's right in the middle of some of the world's biggest questions of war and peace. This hour, On Point, Three Cups of Tea hero Greg Mortensen on war and peace in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And later this hour, we'll hear from Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid on the latest news from the region. You can join the conversation. Have you been inspired by Greg Mortensen's passion, his mission, and what should his work tell us about the U.S. role in Afghanistan and Pakistan now, about nation building? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is Greg Mortensen, co-founder of the Central Asia Institute and founder of Pennies for Peace. His nonprofit has built more than 130 schools in some of the most remote regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan. The 2006 bestseller, Three Cups of Tea, chronicled his journey from mountaineer to humanitarian. This year he received the Star of Pakistan, that country's highest civil award for promoting peace through education and literacy. His new book is Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Greg Mortensen, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you. I just in Boston a couple days ago, big snowstorm, so I hope you're
we're all fine. I think it's nothing like the Karakoram and nothing like the high mountains that you know so very well. We want to catch up with you just as completely as we can. So many people know your story and know it so intimately from your books and the work you've done, Greg, and we will do that. We want to know what you've been up to since Three Cups of Tea time. But I wish you'd start just by giving us your sort of interior monologue last week. I'm sure you watched President Obama's speech on Afghanistan. What were you thinking as the United States Commander-in-Chief laid out the 30,000 troop surge to Afghanistan? What was your reaction?
Well, I was giving a talk that evening, so I didn't actually hear his speech. I did read about it. I read it. Mm-hmm. The couple things that were concerned to me is, number one, that there were 9 meetings held in secrecy to determine, assess the deployment of troops. These were behind closed doors. President Obama met with the military generals and some advisors. There was no public testimony on Capitol Hill. There was no hearings in Congress. I really think that it's a decision that should have been made more openly. The other thing is that there was no consultation with the elders or the shura in Afghanistan. Every province has about 10 to 20 shura, and the real power base, or at least the people who are really revered, these are elders. Some of them are poets, mujahideen, or warriors, or successful businessmen. I can tell you also that we've been helping on my own volition without any compensation to help General McChrystal meet with dozens of shura over the last, since May this year. He was appointed in April after General McKiernan got fired. Mm-hmm. And so it's been interesting to hear what the shura have to say
After their meetings with him. But here we are looking at an American policy pulled out of, what, years now of experience there. I mean, one of the most fascinating parts of your new book, Stones into Schools, is that you are interacting with the U.S. military quite a bit. They've all read Three Cups of Tea. You come to them, they come to you for advice now. Do you see, however it was developed, do you see a winning strategy in what's been announced in these last several days, Greg Mortensen?
Well, I have mixed feelings. Deployment of more troops will inherently or naturally escalate the violence. Unfortunately, there's going to be more U.S. casualties, and the U.S. public will really have to decide whether it's an investment that we want to make. On the other hand, there's a lot of good things happening in Afghanistan. In 2000, there were 800,000 children in school. This is at the height of the Taliban, Tom. Today, 9 years later, There are 8.4 million children in school, including 2.5 million females. So this is the greatest increase in school enrollment in any country in modern history. There are 80,000 troops trained. The goal is 180,000. There's been a central banking systems put into place in 2006. There's an Eisenhower-era road-building program. There's if you go into the district courts, the number of women especially filing titles for land ownership is skyrocketing. And then on the other hand, the Taliban have bombed or burned or destroyed over 1,000 schools in Afghanistan in the last 2.5 years, and another about 800 schools in Pakistan. And what's interesting is that about 90% of the schools, they're girls' schools, and they're not boys' schools. Mm-hmm. And I really think their greatest fear, the Taliban, it's not a bullet, but it's a pen. And what they fear the most is if a girl gets an education, grows up, becomes a mother, the value of education goes on in the community. And as regards to your earlier question about the troops, I think one thing that the American public is not aware of is that of the 22,000 troops originally deployed to Afghanistan this year, 8,000 were trainer troops. Most of these are National Guardsmen. They're reservists. They're veterinarians. They're horticulturalists, hydrologists, accountants, and they're helping train the people. And also, of the 30,000 troops being deployed, and I don't have this exact figure, but I think about 8,000, again, are trainer troops. And what the Shura are telling me and General McChrystal is that we don't need firepower, but we need brain power. So they're actually grateful to have people helping them develop their own capacity. But on the other hand, they say that you do not need to bring firepower here. If you don't like somebody or you need to get rid of somebody, you tell us and then we'll take care of them.
Greg, your vision and your work are so inspiring. I mean, 3 million plus people have bought the book Three Cups of Tea, and there's a reason for that. The idea of going to the remotest parts of the world, the remotest parts of these countries, building schools, seeing communities rally around those schools and be lifted up by them, it's very inspiring. But when you see 800, and women's girls' education has been central to what you've been preaching, but when you see 800 girls' schools burned down, as you say, what does that tell you about firepower versus brain power and how they interact in this setting?
Well, it's going to be a very long road, and ultimately, I think the real hope is with the children in school now, these 2.5 million girls in school. What happens with girls' education, the infant mortality drops, the population decreases, the quality of health improves, the girls generally teach their mothers how to read and write. You also see people coming home from the marketplace with meat or vegetables wrapped in newspaper. And the daughter will then read the news to her mother, and it's very powerful for a woman to be able to read the news. Also, when someone goes on jihad, and a jihad means a quest, they should first get permission from their mother. And if they don't, it's very shameful or disgraceful. And that happened after 9/11, and even today, the Taliban primarily target illiterate, impoverished society because many educated women, even at risk of their lives, do not condone their sons to get into terrorism or violence. The Taliban also they're not so much now a monolithic ideological type of entity. The Taliban they're very fractured. There are many different groups, more like a mafia. I was at Camp Lejeune, which is the Marine Corps Special Forces Command. And I spent a couple days there, and they told me that some of our Marine Corps now deploys embeds with gangs in Los Angeles because in dealing with the Taliban, they're more like a criminal element rather than or mafia, rather than just a type of guerrilla warfare.
So what's your sense of what the United States should most importantly best be doing that? I mean, there you were, kind of a one-man band in the beginning, building a single school. Now so many and quite a legacy. I mean, when schools are being burnt down, yes, they may be great for shaping a culture, but when they're being burned down, do you need a soldier, an American soldier, at the end of the lane with a gun protecting that school? Do we need 100,000 American soldiers soon enough in Afghanistan or not? Should it be brigades of American school builders?
Well, it would be wonderful if we had brigades of school builders. I read some columnists saying we need legions of Birkenstock warriors, but the problem is you're not going to get many people to go to Afghanistan right now. And unfortunately, now our military, the soldiers have to wear three caps. They have to be a humanitarian, a diplomat, and a warrior. And some of the aid groups are critical because the DOD is getting quite a bit more funding. But the problem is that they say they can't work in those areas unless there's security. And I actually disagree. We've been able to work in very volatile areas where there even is no U.S. military presence, like in Nuristan and Uruzgan province in Afghanistan. But we can do that because we have relationships with the elders. And I think it's imperative that especially our government, our political leaders, they do really start working on the relationships. And that's where I can say that the military, I think, is ahead of the State Department and President Obama and our leaders. The military has been working very hard in the last 2-3 years to foster relationships. If you go into a forward operating base in a very remote area, if you went there 2 years ago, you'd see on a chart in the command room that they have, we have 120 men, 50 mm-hmm. machine guns, and mm-hmm. today you'll see a grid with a matrix on it. It'll have all the key players in the area, the head imams, the religious leaders, the militia leaders, the tribal leaders, and their mandate is to go out and build relationships. I was very pleased that finally last week Hillary Clinton and recently Joe Biden went to Afghanistan for the first time. And they only spent a couple hours there, but at least that's a good start.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Three Cups of Tea hero and school builder Greg Mortensen about war and peace in Afghanistan and Pakistan. CNN correspondent Christian Amanpour visited one of Greg Mortensen's schools in eastern Afghanistan for the CNN documentary Generation Islam. Here's what she saw.
One, two, three.
Several thousand students diligently counting in English.
From Greg Mortensen's Three Cups of Tea schools, and hear the voices of girls from one of those schools on what they aspire to be.
I want to be a doctor.
I want to become a lawyer.
I want to become a teacher.
I want to be a police inspector.
They want all that. The United States is in hip deep in Afghanistan and pretty close to that in Pakistan. Here's White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs talking about President Obama's recent surge strategy. This is on CBS Morning News last Tuesday, saying to Americans that the goal was not nation building.
We're going to accelerate going after al-Qaeda and its extremist allies. We're going to accelerate the training of an Afghan national security force, a police, and an army, because we want to, as quickly as possible, transition the security of the Afghan people over to those national security forces in Afghanistan. This can't be nation building. It can't be an open-ended forever commitment.
This can't be nation building, says the White House spokesman there. Greg Mortensen joins us today from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Greg, we have a lot of listeners lined up to speak with you. Sebastian in Auburn, Alabama, you're on the air with Greg Mortensen.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I think Greg has it right. Education is the key to helping them realize that there's a whole world around them and really to reach a harmony between our ideals and their leaders and themselves as well.
And what do you do when the bullets are flying, when the Taliban is at the edge of the village, maybe at the back window of the school?
They have to follow reason rather than the law itself. And education is the only way to infuse greater reason in their daily lives.
Follow reason. Greg, what's your confidence level? We've got 18 months until some transition begins, we're told. I mean, is that time for this policy to begin to work? And what about the idea you heard there from Robert Gibbs? No nation building, please.
Well, I guess I disagree. Maybe the word nation building is not the right word, but I think building relationships. Another reason the Taliban don't attack our schools is because...
When you say our, you mean Central Asia Institute.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And we provide skilled labor materials and also teacher training to set up a school, but the community has to provide free land, free resources, and then free or subsidized manual labor, 2,000 to 5,000 days of free manual labor. And what that does is it ensures a local buy-in. And only recently has there been some type of groups, you know, I really encourage this in the PRT, that's the Provincial Reconstruction Team of the military, mm-hmm. or USAID or other groups, it's imperative that they first develop relationship with the people, and then they insist on local, like reciprocity, you know, some kind of mutual collaboration. And what that does is it ensures a local buy-in. And that's I think, so another way also. The Taliban are very reluctant to attack schools that the community has such fierce desire to support.
And yet, and you described the number burned down yourself. You've talked with a lot of military out there at this point. In your new book, Stones into Schools, it's very striking, your interaction with Chris Kalenda, U.S. Army officer out in Kunar, very tough region of Afghanistan. This is a guy who grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, went to grad school at University of Wisconsin. Now he's out there, and he's got a three cups of tea bug. He wants to work it out with you. He's one of those guys, I assume, who would put the matrix of local leaders up on the wall. And yet we all remember last summer when, you know, U.S. troops came under terrible, withering fire in Kunar with big losses out there. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to be in the gun sights of the guys who want to come into town as Taliban.
All right. I have tremendous respect for Colonel Kalenda. He is the now chief advisor to General McChrystal. Two years ago, he sent me an email, and what he said is that he was convinced that the long-term solution to terrorism is education. He said, this is a conflict that will not be won with bombs and bullets, but with books and ideas that excite the imagination towards peace, tolerance, and prosperity. And he said, it is education that will make the difference whether the next generation grows up to be educated patriots or illiterate fighters. We have 9 schools right where he was posted. It's right in smack in the middle of where there's a lot of war going on right now. Mm-hmm. The Taliban, and our schools haven't been touched. And we've had to do a few things like hire some former Taliban to teach in the schools. That seems maybe a little controversial, but they have become our greatest advocates for education. And what's interesting is that they all got out of the Taliban because their mothers told them what they're doing is not a good thing. And Christopher Kalenda, in the areas he worked, although there's still a lot of fighting, there has been a lot of progress in empowering the local people.
Let's get a question, a comment from Port Huron, Michigan. And Michael, you're on the air with Greg Mortensen.
Yes, thank you, Tom, and thank you, Greg. I really appreciate all the work that you've done. I've read your book. I've passed out a leaflet in front of the New York Stock Exchange recommending it. And I'm wondering, at this point, how many schools have you built and how many have had to be shut down or destroyed by the Taliban or any of the insurgent or the violent people? I think what you do probably protects you to some degree, and I'm wondering how that's gone.
Thank you, Michael. Greg?
Thanks, Michael. We have 131 schools. We also run 60 more schools. These other schools are in tents or in refugee camps or areas of conflict or natural disaster. None of our schools have been shut down. Also, CARE, another incredible organization, none of their 200 schools have been shut down by the Taliban. But the key is that we are working with the local communities, and we also get some type of agreement for them. We did have one school attacked by the Taliban 2 years ago. I'll just briefly share that story. Mm-hmm. They came in at night. They beat up the night watchman. These are 14 Taliban. The next day, they said, if anybody comes to school, we're going to kill you. And this is Lalander School in Charasiab Valley, which is about maybe 2.5 hours south of Kabul. Headmaster got on his bicycle. He pedaled 23 miles. He notified the local militia leader named Commandant Fahim. Now, Fahim is kind of a shady guy, but he also has 2 daughters in school. So he rounded up a Lashkar. Lashkar is a local posse or vigilante, 120 men. He came in, he attacked the Taliban, he killed 2 of them, and then he very quickly, for lack of better words, extracted information from the other Taliban. He found out they had gotten $3,000 from the local mullah to shut the school down. So today, the mullah and 3 Taliban are in prison, and he's appointed 12 askar, these are militiamen, to guard the school 24/7. And their orders are, if anybody harms any child or any teacher coming to school, you just shoot them. Now, that's not how we run a school, but that's how they run a school. And there has never been any attack since Commandant Fahim has come in and protected the school.
Well, that's quite a story and a demonstration of local support for your work. What if you wore a U.S. military uniform? Would you have that same support? It's been difficult, by all accounts, for the U.S. military to train up Afghan military and police. You've got volunteers there doing it, a Lashkar, a posse. Can a soldier do the same thing that you do, have done?
Yeah, well, Tom, it's difficult. We don't take any armed guards with us. That's one of the things that the Shura, the elders, are saying, that the U.S. has to take off their armor and their weapons if they really want to interact. And the U.S. military, actually, when they do have meetings in many areas, they take their weapons and armor off and then go into the compound and have a jirga. It's like a tribal meeting. That's done quite a bit. It does win a lot of respect. You know, on the other hand, there is some exposure, but that's one of the main complaints. The other complaint of the Shura, the number one complaint is, please do not bomb and kill civilians. And that is their number one request. And what Vice President Joe Biden is recommending, along with conservative columnist George Will, is to pull out troops and do more selected bombings. But the problem with bombings is you kill civilians. And if there's anything that can antagonize people, it's bombings and killings of civilians. So I don't necessarily think that replacement of, you know, actual troops is to increase bombings. And also, if you do bombings, you need intelligence. You can't do bombings without intelligence on the ground.
So it sounds as though you're favoring this surge, and yet, you know, your title is Books, Not Bombs, and bombs are kind of part of the military package, though I guess you'd say, no, thank you. Leave it to the on-the-ground work.
Yeah, and the surge is, what I really favor are whoever it is, whether it's the military or the State Department or political leaders, going over and sitting down and listening to the Shura. The Afghan government's very corrupt. It's very fickle. And the Shura, when the reconstruction policy was set up in Afghanistan at the Bonn Conference in December 2001, it was set up, 18 nations got together and decided how to rebuild the country. Mm-hmm. But they set up a centralized, deprovincialized process, which is exactly the opposite of the Marshall Plan after World War II. That was a provincialized, decentralized process. And only recently, in the last couple of years, has that started to change. And I keep saying it again, but mm-hmm. General Petraeus was interviewed on NPR after a International Strategic Military Summit in Berlin. This was in March, I think. Mm-hmm. And this serious NPR correspondent asked him, you know, what should be our top priority in Afghanistan? And he answered, you know, deadpan, dead serious, we need to go and drink more tea with the locals. And the correspondent, you know, said, well, let's get serious here. He said, no, we need to drink more tea. And General Petraeus, who has read Three Cups of Tea, said he had gleaned three important points from the book. And he said, number one, that we need to listen more. Number two, we need to have respect. And number three, that we have to build relationships. And I have great respect for him also. Like Admiral Mullen, at the beginning of his speech at the American Legion National Convention in August, he said, we, meaning the U.S., have been far too arrogant in the world, and we need to go out and serve with humility. So what I'm seeing is these military leaders really showing some visionary leadership, trying to build relationships with the locals. I haven't yet seen that from the State Department and our political leaders. So hopefully, you know, that'll just start. Hillary Clinton did come to Afghanistan and Pakistan recently, and I give her great credit. Just her showing up, having a cup of tea, it's worth $1 billion of military aid. But I hope they do that more. This was a very, very short visit in both countries.
Kim's calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Kim, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Greg.
Hi.
Hi there. I met Greg in the spring of 2002, and my husband was a physician, and he had died on 9/11. And I asked Greg if there might be some way he could get my late husband's books to Afghanistan to help train young physicians there. And Greg very much obliged, and I've been following his work ever since, and I'm a huge admirer of his efforts. And I think he's doing just a great deal there abroad to help promote more tolerance and understanding in the world through education. I'd like to see a similar effort here in this country. I think we could do more in the U.S. to learn about other cultures, to learn about their ways of life. I'd like to see an effort in the schools in the U.S. to promote that type of cultural curiosity, and I'd love to hear kind of Greg's perspective on what it might take to get something like that done in the States.
Kim, thank you for your call. Greg Mortensen, this is someone who lost a partner on 9/11, whose books you took to Afghanistan. But what about her question? You speak all over the country and get a heck of a turnout when you do. Nevertheless, you've also complained Americans aren't plugged in enough to what's going on there sometimes. Is there a contradiction? How do you fix it?
Well, first, Kim is an incredible woman. She lost her husband. She was the first 9/11 widow that really reached out to us and with forgiveness to the people. And I brought her books to the her husband, Fred, his books to the library in Afghanistan at the medical school. And she also changed her whole life. She's devoted now to serving people and impoverished people in the Boston area. Mm. And so, Kim, thank you very much. One of our things we do is I visit about 200 schools a year, not just me, but other people, and we have a program called Pennies for Peace.
You're talking American schools here.
Yes, mm-hmm. And this is urban and public schools. And Pennies for Peace is a program designed to teach kids about philanthropy and about giving and sharing. But we also, when I visit schools, these are, you know, from kindergarten to the Air Force Academy, I ask kids, students, how many of you have talked in great detail to your grandparents or your elders about the Depression or World War II or the Vietnam War? And the average in the States is about 10%. It doesn't matter if it's a public or a private school. And in Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's about 90 to 100%. And so one of the things we do in our Pays for Peace program is we encourage kids to spend time with their elders and learn about our folklore and our culture and our heritage and traditions, and not only that, about other children's culture. And I really think, Kim is also believes in this, that the real hope for the future is our children. And we really, you know, we can't live in fear. We have to live in hope. And I think fighting terrorism, it's based in fear. And promoting peace is based in hope. And the real enemy we all face is ignorance. And it's ignorance that breeds hatred. Yeah. I grew up in Africa. Mm-hmm. And as a child, I learned a proverb. It says, if we educate a boy, we educate an individual. But if we can educate a girl, we educate a community. And I really think that's true.
A lot of Americans have been thinking about Afghan girls if and when the U.S. goes. A lot of Americans would like the U.S. to pull out of Afghanistan. The country is very divided on this. What about the future of your work beyond a NATO military presence there?
Well, our work will go on regardless of whether or not the U.S. has a military presence or not. It might be a little more difficult, but we're committed to the long run. I can't tell you, Tom, the tenacity and the desire of girls and children to go to school. There were 14 young women going to Mir Vice High School in Kandahar last November, and they had battery acid sprayed on their faces. Mm-hmm. They obviously severe burns. They were blind. This March, they came back to school and they celebrated. They said the only way the Taliban can stop us is they're going to have to kill us. And that's an extreme example, but that just shows you the dedication of those young women.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with Greg Mortensen. Millions around the world know him from Three Cups of Tea and his transition from mountaineer to humanitarian in the far northern mountains of Pakistan. Now he's moved his school building operations into Afghanistan as well, some of the most remote areas and some of the areas where the Taliban has been strongest. He joins us today from Albuquerque, New Mexico. His new book is Stones into Schools. Greg, a couple of comments from Facebook. Mindy says, love this man. I think he's right on in his work and that bringing education for both boys and girls is what's needed to empower small communities around the world. Kenneth says online, we desperately need a different approach or Afghanistan will become the American Waterloo. Let's go to Francis in Whately, Massachusetts. Francis, you're on the air.
Hi.
What's your question?
I was was just wondering, when I read Three Cups of Tea, Greg was talking about how in northern Pakistan there were a number of madrasas that were funded by the Saudis. And I was wondering, in any of his policy work or talking to anyone, he heard that anything was being done about that as far as trying to find diplomatic routes or find other alternatives for the people in that area?
Yes, thank you, Francis. Greg, the interaction between your schools and fundamentalist madrasas?
And maybe, Tom, when Ahmed Rashid comes on, mm-hmm. you can talk to him. He's an expert on this. In his book, Taliban, he wrote that in 1980, there were 900 extremist madrasas. I think it's important to clarify here. A madrasa means a school, and you know, 99% of madrasas are very similar to bar mitzvah, confirmation, or catechism. It's where children mm-hmm. learn about the Holy Quran and Islam. But there has been a proliferation of extremist madrasas. As I mentioned, Ahmed Rashid says in 1980 there were 900. Mm-hmm. In Pakistan and Afghanistan today, there are 25,000 extremist madrasas. About 4 million young boys and a few girls go to school in these madrasas. And in there, they're in very violent, extremist type of ideology, very militant ideology. And it is one of the main recruiting grounds of the Taliban and many other groups, Lashkar-e-Taiba, Jamaat-Islamia, to get recruits. And in those madrasas, the kids are merely learning by rote. One thing that we do in our schools is we teach 5 languages by 5th grade, including Arabic and English, also Pashto, Dari, Urdu, and Pakistan. And they have to not only learn how to read and write Arabic, but they have to learn to understand Arabic. And that's the difference. The kids in these extremist madrasas, they do not learn Arabic. They just learn how to read it, but they don't understand what the Holy Quran is teaching them. And in the Quran, there's nothing that says that girls can't go to school. In fact, the Quran implores all people have a quest for knowledge and seek the truth, meaning get out and get an education. The first word in the Holy Quran of the revelation to Muhammad the Prophet is the Arabic word ikra. And Iqra means read. In the Hadith, also, which is a part of Islam, it says that the ink of a scholar is holier or greater than the blood of a martyr. And that means that the pen is more powerful than the sword. And these come directly from the teachings of Islam.
So it's daunting, though. 25,000 extremist madrasas, 130 of your schools. Of course, they're not the only schools in that region. But how do you keep your hope in that kind of equation? You're watching everything that's going on out there. You know, we've had the warning from General McChrystal himself that the mission could fail, the Taliban could win. You know how serious the fears are about what may happen in Pakistan. How do you keep your hopes alive, Greg Mortensen?
Well, I get my hope from, I have 2 children, and they're very inspiring, but I also think we need to do everything we can to leave all our children a legacy of peace. We have 58,000 students. It's just a drop in the bucket, but 44,000 of those are female. But what I see is the results of having now worked in 17 years in rural Pakistan, Afghanistan, the first fruits of our labor. Many young women are becoming teachers and doctors and lawyers. One woman named Aziza is the first young woman out of 4,000 people to get an education. She comes from she's from the tribal areas on the Afghan border. When she went to school, elementary school, the boys threw stones at her. In high school, the teachers refused to teach her. Anyway, she graduated in 1998. We sent her to 2 years of maternal health care training. And in her valley, 5 to 20 women died in childbirth every single year in childbirth. And so she went to 2 years of training. She came back in 2000, cost $800. And since she started working there 9 years ago, not one single woman has died in childbirth. And, you know, I'm very blessed because I've seen hundreds of examples of what girls' education and empowering women can do.
Taking hope and strength from those individual stories. Karen in Sutton in Quebec, you're on the air with Greg Mortensen. Karen.
Hello. Hello, Tom. Hello, Hi. Greg. Well, I feel very blessed to be able to speak to you, Greg. I've been following your work for many years now, and having spent time in Afghanistan and worked with the women's handicrafts, I wondered, and the wonderful work that they do, I wondered if there was any option in your schooling programs where you could see women also being included to not only do perhaps their handicrafts and carpet making and so on, but also be able to be taught and learn things.
Not just girls, but women as well.
Women, yes.
Greg,
yes.
What do you say?
Yes, we have extensive program. Our schools, we set up poultry farms, poplar tree plantations. We also do women's literacy centers. And in these literacy centers, women not only learn reading and writing, but they learn making handicrafts. And until the spring, we only had 17 women's literacy centers within our schools. And I told the women, why don't you set up your own co-op? You know, do this yourselves. You can do this better than me. And so now we have 130. And, you know, it took us 8 years to get 17 started. Now we have 130 in the last 7 or 8 months. And so last month I told the women to set up their own nonprofit, you know, set up your own NGO. And so they're telling me they're going to have 1,000 of these by next year. So, you know, I should have done this a long time ago, but I'm learning. And once, you know, the women also learn about hygiene, sanitation, nutrition. We give them cell phones. And, you know, when women start communicating, then you really got to watch out.
But it sounds like that's growing. Let me get one more call, if I may. Karen, thank you for yours. Andrew in North Andover, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I just got back from the Peace Corps. I was serving 2 years in Guinea in West Africa.
Great.
And, Greg, I read your book and loved it and was wondering, to what extent is it feasible for the U.S. to put a sort of Peace Corps-like force on the ground in Afghanistan and Pakistan? That is, Americans living at a community level, living at the same way as people there and doing public health work and education and community work. Given the security situation and our current foreign policy, would that be at all possible?
Great question. Greg Mortensen.
Well, first, thanks for your service. And I really think groups like the Peace Corps, you know, even here in the States, AmeriCorps, Teach for America, incredible organizations that really, you know, have that spirit of volunteerism and helping out people. Well, I think it's possible. Obviously it can't be done in all areas, but, you know, why not start it out? One of our problems is we have a hard time to have volunteers because the U.S. State Department has issued a travel advisory and warned U.S. citizens not to go to Afghanistan. This has been going on for a decade, and we have had some people come over with very remarkable success. So I do think it's feasible. On the other hand, it is risky. There's been more and more, you know, IEDs and roadside bombings and suicide bombings. So, there is going to be some risk involved. So I guess one would have to kind of assess that, you know, is it worth the risk or not? And I think it's worth the risk. And once you become, have, you know, 3 cups of tea or become friends with the people, Pashto culture, there's a word named Nenawati, which means the right of refuge. And by the tribal etiquette and their laws, they're supposed to protect you with their lives. And it's a very important point that they give you hospitality and they protect you. And I go in under that auspices. And the word is Nenawati.
When do you hope that U.S. troops are dramatically reduced in number in Afghanistan or even out? Everyone's thinking about when. What's your hope, Greg?
Well, I think if we seriously start talking with the Shura and the elders, I think it's possible in about 3 to 5 years. I don't necessarily think part of the surge, which is frustrating, is that part of the, if you read the McChrystal report, which I encourage all the listeners to read, it's 68 pages and it reads more like a thesis in anthropology or sociology. It's not very complicated. And I think it's important that people actually read the McChrystal report. And it's available online. Mm. I think that they're pulling back troops now, though, from the forward operating bases, these very remote posts, and putting them to guard the more urban areas in Kandahar and Kabul. Mm. And unfortunately, all of that work and those relationship building, everything, all of that is now being tossed out the door with the deployment of more troops. So that, to me, is unfortunate because the real problems are in the rural areas. They're not in the city. So that's been very frustrating to see that happen.
Greg Mortensen, we wish you good luck with your work. We hope you'll come back and report in on your work and on how you see the situation evolving in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks, Tom. And give my greetings to Ahmed Rashid. I have incredible admiration for him. He's a good friend. So thanks, Tom.
He'll be with us in just a second here from Pakistan. Greg Mortensen there, now author of Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He joined us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. We turn now to Lahore, Pakistan for the latest from the region. Ahmad Rashid is a Pakistani journalist and best-selling author. His most recent book is Descent into Chaos, How the War against Islamic Extremism is being lost in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. He's been following reaction to President Obama's troop surge plan. Ahmad Rashid, welcome. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for being here.
Tom, thank you very much.
And we pass on greetings to you from Greg Mortensen, who we just had on the air with us a few seconds ago. So his best to you, Ahmad.
Thank you. He's a great guy.
He is indeed, with many fans and followers inspired there. What can you tell us about the response in the last week to President Obama's big speech of new American troop plans last week, Ahmad? How's it being received first in Pakistan, where you are now?
Well, I think the common reaction in Pakistan and Afghanistan has been this enormous concern about the date that Obama set for the start of a possible U.S. withdrawal. Now, unfortunately, in his speech, he didn't really explain it properly to say that this was the start. And a lot of people read this as saying, well, the U.S. is going to exit from Afghanistan, exit from this region. I spoke to many Afghans. They were deeply, deeply worried. And what we saw after the speech, of course, was the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and Bob Gates coming out on TV very strongly saying this is only the start, that this would only signal the start of a U.S. withdrawal and a transition to Afghan security forces. Now, I think in recent days we've had President Karzai come on and say that, in fact, the Afghan forces and the Afghan government is not going to be ready in 2 years. It'll probably take 2 to 5 years before they are really ready. So I think that, you know, there are a lot of differences right now between Karzai and the Americans as to exactly differences on how to talk to the Taliban, on when Afghan forces will be ready to take over in some of the provinces, how the civilian surge will work out. And, of course, in Pakistan, there is huge American pressure now for the Pakistan Army to go up against the Afghan Taliban, who are who have sanctuaries and safe havens in Pakistan. And so far, at least, there seems to be a very big gap between the Americans and the Pakistani position. Pakistan is the only ally in the world that has so far not welcomed the Obama plan or really issued any statement about it.
Ahmad, do you feel a sense of optimism? I mean, your book title is famously kind of pessimistic about what's been going on, Descent into Chaos. Do you see any turn in that drift with the long strategy consideration of the Obama White House and the new surge plans announced? Or do you see the same dynamic, descent into chaos?
No, I'm certain that with these additional U.S. troops and this new counterinsurgency strategy put in place by the U.S. military, I'm sure this will be much more effective over the next 18 months or so than what we saw under the Bush administration when there were too few troops and not a very good strategy. At the same time, the civilian surge is very important, and for the first time in 9 years, you've got the American involvement in funding and aiding agriculture, which it provides livelihoods for 80% of the population, which again was something that the Americans didn't do for 7 years. But there are several factors that are of concern. First of all, this transition, I mean, it's only 18 months away. And frankly, I don't think many people see the Afghans being able to transition in this kind of shorter time. In other words, you know, the Afghan government, will it be prepared to govern effectively? Will it have people in the provinces? Will the Afghan army be able to take over, etc.? That's one very big problem. And I think the timeline here will probably be much longer than what the Americans are talking about at the moment. The second problem is Pakistan. Mm. This is a huge problem because as long as the Taliban leadership is living in Pakistan and is able to provide recruits and fighters and logistics and food and supplies, you know, to their fighters inside Afghanistan, no matter how many American or NATO troops you send, it's not going to make much of a difference. So I think this is a crucial part of the equation. And it's still an open question as to exactly how the Pakistan military is going to respond.
And we've just got a minute left, Ahmad. But over the weekend, the National Security Advisor in Washington, General James Jones, said that there were plans to put new effort into tracking down Osama bin Laden after all these years. Is there reason to believe that he's still in that territory? Reason to believe that he could be tracked down if he has not been in all these years since 2001?
Well, I mean, nobody has any information about him except, you know, we keep getting these regular radio or internet broadcasts and statements that he puts out, and similarly, his lieutenants put out statements. I'm sure there will be a stepped up search for him, but the problem again is that he's believed to be on the Pakistan side of the border. And, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, General Musharraf, the former president of Pakistan, said that the Pakistanis had stopped looking for him largely because it was irrelevant to Pakistan, and Pakistan was more concerned about the Pakistani Taliban, which the Pakistan army is presently fighting. Now, clearly, the Americans, given that they cannot cross the border into Pakistan, are going to have to rely very heavily on Pakistani intelligence.
Ahmad Rashid, with that, we're out of time, I'm afraid, but we're grateful to you for being with us. New President's Old Search. Ahmad Rashid there from Lahore, Pakistan. Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.